So this time, this session here, I'll be talking about the hierarchy, but now some really important theological issues arise at this time. So we're looking at leadership in the church. That's our topic, organizational leadership. Intrinsically linked, says the Catechism, to the sacramental nature of church ministry is its character of service. Now, that's not news to you, that's what it's for. Again, a little later in the Catechism, sacramental ministry in the church is at once a collegial, together, and a personal service. So we've just got a new bishop appointed, or archbishop appointed, so his function is to combine with the other bishops in this area and whatever, and then with the priests and with the deacons and with you, and in a collegial way to offer his particular gifts to the archdiocese. Communities are not autonomous, but they're to be linked in a communion of love. Some, inverted commas, Christian churches are autonomous. They make their own decisions and no one can... We've got a complicated system, but it's basically a good one, where we are able, as Catholics, to be influenced by other parts of the world and not just locked into our own, maybe narrow way. So Vatican II was possible in the Catholic Church, and all parishes changed. They changed where the altar was, they changed where the priest... You know, they were told to, so they did. Well, if you're autonomous, can you imagine how... Would anything have changed? I think the people in charge of the local area could well have stymied nearly everything. So it's a complex system, but that's what it's for. In number 881, the Catechism focuses on the special role among the apostles given by Jesus to Peter. No Christian would argue with this. It's clearly the case. Then the Catechism goes on to link the role of Peter with that of the bishops of Rome. Well, that link, of course, is very traditional for us, but every other church wouldn't be too quick to make that link. Why was this connection with Rome so important? Well, it's historical. Peter was martyred in Rome and so was Paul. And it was the heroic faith of the Church of Rome which suffered the first state-instituted persecution under the Emperor Nero. Up till then, there were crowds, lynch crowds, who would, if the season didn't go well, they blamed the Christian community in Ephesus or somewhere else because they weren't praying to their gods, and so they'd blame them for the bad season, and they were easy targets. So there was a lot of that stuff going on in the mixed-up cultures, but an organised state persecution didn't happen anywhere till it happened under Nero in Rome. That's one factor of it. The church was heroic in its faith. And so because Rome is Rome in the Roman Empire, and because of this heroic faith, people looked to Rome for help, for guidance, for trust, for the way you'd go to a wise person to help you in your life. If you're a mother, will you go to a wise mother to see what do you do? So in the Christian church, for centuries, the Bishop of Rome was seen as a symbol of the communion of all the churches in the world, one, that they may be one. That's historically the fact, and I know you know that. Now, the church, unfortunately, experienced breaks in her unity, which we call schism. Constantine, the emperor who embraced Christianity, moved his residence from Rome to Constantinople. Almost immediately. Understandably, the Diocese of Constantinople saw itself as a new Rome, and rivalry broke out between the patriarchs of Rome and Constantinople. Excuse me. Some of it is power, obviously. Some of it is trying to hold on to a truth that could be lost if this happens. So, as in all of our lives, the complexity of decision-making is not to be simplified. The division between the Western and Eastern churches hardened in the 11th century with reciprocal excommunications. And though both sides have withdrawn the excommunications, the schism, sadly, persists to the present day. Pope John Paul II did a lot to try and mend it. And he talked about the church has to breathe with both lungs, the East and the West. And there's a lot of work going on at, let's say, the top level of church diplomacy to try to bring these communities together. Which is can be part of a problem too, because in the East part, I think this is probably a generalisation, but you forgive me if it's too general, but on the whole, many of the cultures in Eastern Europe and to the East, they're very different from our culture in the West. So we might be ready for some things, e.g. women priests. The Orthodox Church couldn't cope with it at all. I mean, it'd put an end to any communion between the East and the West. So you still got to do the truth in love, but you're aware of some of the complications, that's all. Now, another major break came with the emergence of nationalism in Western Europe in the 16th century. Nations broke away from the so-called Holy Roman Empire, and they took the church with them. And basically, the people in Germany, they solved the problem, because families were being torn apart. Some wanted to be Catholic and some wanted to be Lutheran. And so they decided eventually, look, whatever the prince is, you have to be that. It was the only way of getting peace. So if your prince happened to be Lutheran, everybody in the princedom was Lutheran. No faith in it, it's just that's the organisation. And it worked pretty well. It stopped the war, the West, you know, the 30 years war that had gone on. It created a peace thing. And the Lutherans are very close to us anyhow. So, but that's how they worked it. And then Western Germany and Southern Germany were all Catholic. North and East were Protestant or Lutheran. Do you think that's got anything to do with faith? I don't think so. It's got to do with geography. And so it was throughout the war. Now, for the churches in the West and in the East that are in communion with Rome, and there are many, the Pope is still the focus of unity. And Vatican II says the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, and Peter's successor is the perpetual and visible source and foundation of the unity both of the bishops and of the whole company of the faithful. All that's familiar. This point is terribly important and it mightn't be familiar. The Catechism, quoting Vatican II, states, the individual bishops are the visible source and foundation of unity in their own particular churches. Conclusion, it's wrong to think of the Pope as a kind of general manager and the other bishops as branch managers, but that would be the normal way it's looked at. And if you're as strong as Pope John Paul II as a character, you're likely to go to a particular part of the world as bishop and all the attention is on you. I so wish he hadn't allowed that. I so wish he hadn't have played second fiddle to the local bishop. Do you know what I mean? Because in the local area, the bishop is the symbol of unity of this particular church. So I'm hoping that when Pope Francis comes to Canberra, maybe he will, maybe he won't, but if he comes to Canberra, I'm almost certain what he'll do is he'll say, oh no, it's all right, you know, he'll give way to the local bishop. You know, because he's not the general manager. He's a symbol of something to advise, to present, and he's already doing that, by the way, in some ways, simplicity and all. So to carry that right through, we don't need a pope who is the general manager of the church. We need someone who's a symbol of faith and communion and humility and Jesus' lifestyle and all the rest of it. The Catechism insists, thank God, sometimes I had to search for these little insistences, but I'm giving them to you, because from the rest of it you mightn't get the impression. The bishops, this is from the Catechism, number 895, should not be thought of as vicars of the Pope. But you talk to any of your Protestant people around you, or any Catholics in the parish, I bet, without realising it, they think of the local bishop as a representative of the Pope. Well, he's not. He's not. The representative of the Pope is the apostolic delegate, or he's a diplomatic, and they have immense power. The bishops that get appointed here are determined a lot. Well, no one knows, by the way. It's all very secretive. I've spoken to plenty of bishops and haven't the faintest idea. And so they send it around, priests get a say of who they might, and there's never any connection between who the priests want and who's appointed. So it's well, there isn't. It's a phony business, really, honestly. But it happens, and some priests just think, who cares? I mean, you know. So, and mostly, thank God, you're dealing with good people, so it'll work out. And if it doesn't, you keep going. Or as my mother used to say, in a tornado, the oak tree gets smashed to the ground. The blade of grass bends with the wind, and when the wind stops, it goes back again. So you... And then you do what we're all good at. So it's a complex. Each bishop is graced to govern each local community in such a way that the communion is preserved throughout the universal Catholic Church. Earlier we noted that the Catechism speaks of each member of the Church sharing in the life and mission of Christ, the priest, prophet and king. In number 893 to 896, the Catechism makes more precise the way in which ordained presbyters, or the priests, exercise this ministry. It's another way of doing it. The teaching office exercised by bishops in the Church, the Catechism states, the pastoral duty of the magisterium, that's the teaching authority, from the word magister in Latin, which means teacher, is aimed at seeing to it that the people of God abides in the truth that liberates. That's very good. The statements are often really good. It's all about truth, and it's about liberation. It's not about control or ideology. It's about the truth. So that each person, Jesus' mission, is he put in his own beautiful words, I've come that you may live to the full. That's the whole purpose of Christianity, so that people's lives will be full human life, which they call salvation, full human life, freed from stuff out there and stuff in here. And the stuff in here is often worse. That's what the teaching authority is for, to liberate you and me to live our life. Ultimately, the truth, of course, is the truth about God revealed by Jesus. So it's in this context that we speak of the, now topic, infallibility. The Church is said to be infallible. What do we mean? Where's the focus got to be? The word infallibility derives from the passive of the Latin verb meaning to deceive. Falli is the passive. It means that Jesus guarantees the grace to preserve the Church, the body, from being deceived and so falling irretrievably into error. It's possible for individual Christians to be wrong, even seriously wrong, in what they believe and how they live. This can happen to whole communities. It's conceivable that the whole church could be in error on a particular issue at a particular moment in its history. Papal teaching justifying slavery is a particularly striking example of how wrong the teaching can be from the highest level. There's plenty of examples of that. So we could all be wrong. Bishops could be wrong, popes can be wrong, and they have been, and I can be wrong and you can be wrong. But there's something deeper than that that's guaranteeing infallibility. We are assured by Jesus that he will not leave us to our own devices, but will give us his Spirit to guide the church into the fullness of truth. We have Jesus' guarantee for this. That's the basis of infallibility. Quoting Vatican II, the Catechism states, by a supernatural sense of faith, the people of God, under the guidance of the Church's living magisterium, unfailingly adheres to this faith. The power of God's redeeming love will continue to break down resistance to it. Despite human failure, sin, infidelity, Jesus' mission will continue. That's our belief. For this to happen, Jesus promises the Church that the true faith will win through because Jesus will be with the Church until the end of time. I will be with you always, he said, till the end of time. Why is the Church as a whole unable to completely fail and end up deceiving and missing the whole revelation? Because Jesus is constantly present, and there'll always be a saint somewhere. There'll always be someone raised up in a community to keep us on the direction of grace. It's a free thing, but Jesus, it has always happened and will always happen. But it doesn't say there won't be mistakes made along the way. We can surely hope there'll always be someone listening to grace, that there'll always be holy people to draw us back from error. If we make a mistake, it can be corrected. If the Pope makes a mistake, serious mistake, then hopefully there'll be someone in the Vatican who'll say, hey, Francis, or whoever you are, do you realise the implications of what you've said? Or Pope Paul VI, or whatever, you know what I mean? If mistakes are made anywhere, there'll always be someone there, hopefully raised up to correct. And so the Church will always be holding the precious, we had it the other day in the reading, we're all earthen, we're jars, but we've got an ointment, a precious gift that's ours, and it'll always be there for us. At the same time, we cannot but wonder at the cry that came from Jesus' heart when he exclaimed, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? Jesus must have been having a particularly bad day that day. And he thought, is anyone ever going to get the message? Is anyone going to... Because Peter hasn't got it yet, and the apostles haven't got it yet, and the crowd hasn't got it, and the Pharisees, and you know, all the rest of it. You can imagine him thinking... So this infallibility, that is, inability to fail, radically, ultimately, permanently, it's guaranteed the Church by Jesus. It's claimed... For the catechism, by the catechism, for certain statements made by those who are graced to exercise this teaching authority. So, we're talking about papal infallibility in a minute. So, of course, this is some riders. No statement can express the whole truth. No statement, no matter where it comes from, of course it can't. Positive statements are not exclusive. You can't put it all in a statement. It's equally obvious that each statement has to be properly understood within its context, which includes the limitations necessarily involved in any human statement, including statements of the councils, statements of the Pope, statements of anybody. Authoritative statements made by the magisterium are clearest when they define error. It's very like science. Science can say, no, that's not the way to go. It won't work, because they've seen, they've experimented, and they say, well, that's not that. But what is it? Light is not that. But what is it? You know what I mean? What it is always an ongoing exploration. But you can be clear about what isn't. And the Church is best at that. It can say, no, Michael, what you preached last Sunday is not Catholic teaching, and here's the proof. And I have to look and think, oh, I'm sorry. So I get up next Sunday and say, look, what I told you last Sunday was wrong. And correct it. Because that's the best way to solve it. Authoritative statements made by the are clearest when they define error to protect the members of the Church from being deceived in matters of faith. So at the time of the Reformation, smart theologians, and you can be think you're smart, got up with the idea that the Eucharist is really just a ceremony, it's nice, and we're remembering what Jesus did at the Last Supper, that's it. Nice spiritual thing going, but there's nothing happening really. There's no real presence or anything. It's just a lovely way, like you might have a Christmas party to remember, or a birthday party. So it's a meal, and we share it, and any idea of sacramentality, or this was an extreme position, but it was held, and that is gone, and the Church came out in the Trent and said, no, you've got it wrong. Every grandmother knows, every little child knows, every teenager knows that there's a mystery here, there's a presence here, there's a transubstantiation, to use the word. There's a whole wonderful thing that's happening, and it's not what we're doing, it's what God is doing in the Church. He is truly present. Jesus is giving us this bread and wine. It's still bread and wine, of course, physically. There's no physical change. There's no chemical change. It's nothing to do with that. But it is a whole change of meaning and gift. And when you put your hand out and receive communion, and do it on the hand, if you don't mind, to the Last Supper, Jesus said, take it, eat it. He didn't say, pretend you're in hospital and can't move, pop your tongue out and I'll give you... I mean, really, you do what you want to do, but there are people who think that's holier to take it on the tongue. And those very people usually commit more sins with their tongue than their hand. But anyhow, I'm not here to... not here to judge anybody. But just do what everyone else does around you. Just be simple... And, you know, don't, yeah, I'm sorry I said most of that. But anyhow, the aim of statements that purport to express the truth, ultimately, of course, if anyone comes to communion, whatever way they come, the priest is obliged and sensible enough. You offer communion the way people want it. Yeah. So we're not talking about anything embarrassing or humiliating. I have said to some people when I was parish priest, like, just be normal, but do what everyone else does. You know, you don't have to genuflect, because if you genuflect, the person will trip over you. And I said, all you're doing is drawing attention to yourself. You're not drawing attention to Jesus. Do you really want to do that? I have said that to some people, hope kindly, and I don't know how they took any notice, but it's very important to just blend in. There's nothing wrong with taking the host and then you personally taking it in. It's a choice you make. The aim of statements that purport to express the truth is not to lock reality into a proposition. People will fight over propositions. Comprehensively and once for all, you can't do it. The aim is to point us in the right direction. Good theology points us towards the mystery. Bad theology points us away from it. So that we engage what is in the final analysis mysterious. And it's beyond human comprehension. It's essential to remember that all statements must be read in their historical context and necessarily carry with them the limits of horizon within which they're made. This is stated in the following remarks of the Roman Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, Mysterium Ecclesiae, in 1973. I'll just read it to you without comment. In the transmission of divine revelation by the Church, difficulties arise also from the historical condition that affects the expression of revelation. I said I wasn't going to comment, but a little bracket. If something was said in the year 800 at the Council of Somewhere about faith, can't you see that you've got to know what was the question that was being asked, what was the question they were trying to answer? Because if you don't know what the question was, you don't know what the answer was. So it's all history. It's people doing their best to find the best words available to them to answer a particular question. If it's a negative answer, that clears the field. If it's a positive one, it's a humble, imperfect, directional finder to help people keep on the road to discover the ultimate mysterious truth. But you've got to get into the history is everything. The context is everything. Back to them. With regard to this historical condition, it must first be observed that the meaning of the pronouncement of faith depends upon the expressive power of the language used at a certain point in time and in particular circumstances. Go back to the Gospels, brackets again. Go back to the Gospels. They're portraits of Jesus. Unless you know that, you're going to misunderstand them. If you read the Gospels as photos, like videos of what happened, it's all factual material. Nothing wrong with that. But they didn't have videos. But neither did Shakespeare, by the way. But they still have the ability to express in a portrait a foundational truth that's really remarkable. So as you go into a photo thing, I'm not denying the art in photography, I'll just do it simplistically, you might ask questions about the photo. You might say, gee, isn't that interesting? Back in 1900, these are the kind of hats that men wore, or women, when they went swimming in 1899, it's a wonder they didn't drown. You know, they're kind of neck to knees or more. So, you know, we're getting the facts in a photo. If you go into an art gallery, you're not asking the question of fact. You're not asking, why would they have a purple dray in a field in Arles, in southern France, in 18 whatever it was? Why would they do that? That's not the question you ask. You're asking, why did Van Gogh paint it that way? Why did he have the clouds that shape? You're trying to get into the artist's, what he wants to tell you. And he tells you through the art, of course. You can't do it rationally, but he does it that way. So what about who wrote The White Swan and The Black Swan? What's that?
Swan Lake.
Swan Lake? No, what's going... Pardon?
Tchaikovsky.
So what's going on there is an art thing. You're trying to... Your right brain's going flat out enjoying something so that you end up with an insight. So that's what happens. So when you read the Gospels, for example, who were expressing truth fantastically, you've got to know the art. You've got to know how were people writing in the Greek world at that time. When they put on plays by Euripides and all the rest of them, I've said enough and too much. Back to this. Moreover, but I mean, I'm just saying, context is everything. Art form is everything. And if you read everything as though it was a newspaper entry, that's an interesting thought, isn't it? that was truthful. Let's add that bit in. Well, you're boring as hell, and you become a fundamentalist, and you argue, and you win arguments, and you lose arguments, and you die without a thing in your brain. But you're just noisy about it. Moreover, back to them. They didn't say any of that, I did. Back to this text. It sometimes happens that some dogmatic truth is first expressed incompletely, but not falsely, and at a later date, when considered in a broader context of faith or human knowledge, it receives a fuller and more perfect expression. We're always learning. In addition, when the Church makes new pronouncements, it intends to confirm or clarify what is in some way contained in the sacred scripture or in previous expressions of tradition. But at the same time, it usually has the intention of solving certain questions or removing errors. And it continues, all these things have to be taken into account in order that these pronouncements may be properly interpreted. Finally, even though the truths which the Church intends to teach through its dogmatic formulas are distinct from the changeable conceptions of a given epoch and can be expressed without them, nevertheless it can sometimes happen that these truths may be enunciated by the sacred magisterium in terms that bear traces of such conceptions. God, that's an understatement. In addition, it has sometimes happened that certain formulas in the habitual usage of the Church have given way to new expressions which, proposed and approved by the sacred magisterium, presented more clearly or more completely the same meaning. I'm almost sorry I read you all that. It's fairly heavy stuff, but you got the message, I think. The First Vatican Council stated as an article of faith, fundamental to our faith as faithful Christians, that in certain circumstances the infallibility granted to the Church, and that's the basic one, can find expression in statements made by the Pope. And this is what it said. And no one understands this too well. You may not either, but certainly no one outside the Catholic Church understands this, because they think whatever the Pope says, we all click our heels and go ahead. Little do they know. The Roman Pontiff, head of the College of Bishops, enjoys this infallibility in virtue of his office, not his personality, now these are the conditions, as supreme pastor and teacher of all the faithful, he proclaims by a definitive act a doctrine pertaining to faith or morals. I'll come back to that. The infallibility promised to the Church is also present in the body of bishops when, together with Peter's successor, they exercise the supreme magisterium. So the Pope has to be speaking as Pope to the whole Church in communion with all the bishops, and he has to be speaking on matters of faith and morals, and I'll add, because they add it in their notes, as revealed by Christ. So it's a very, very burning central issue we're talking about here. Only that. The Catechism adds, this happens above all in an ecumenical council. But the last council we had, Vatican II, explicitly says none of what it says is infallible. So it's not a kind of a daily issue for us. None of it is. It's their best shot at trying to present the truth but none of it claims infallibility. When the Church, through its supreme magisterium, proposes a doctrine for belief as being divinely revealed, so it's all about what Jesus revealed. Practical issues like birth control, let's take Paul VI, can't be infallible. It's not just that it isn't, it just can't be. Or John Paul II saying you can't talk about women priests. Can't be an infallible statement. If it's not infallible, it's fallible. You got the difference? So if it's not incapable of error, it could be erroneous. So we have to look at it carefully. And as the teaching of Christ, the definitions must be adhered to with an obedience of faith. This infallibility extends as far as the deposit of divine revelation itself. Now, fact, when we note that the only time a pope has invoked this level of authority in the years since it was defined in 1870 was in 1950, when Pope Pius XII defined the dogma of Mary's Assumption. That's the only time infallibility has ever been invoked in 140-something years. Was once. Why did he invoke it then? Forget what's up there for a minute. I'll give you my best guess. The Church had just been through two world wars. The world had. First World War, Second World War. The First World War was an absolute madness, as you'd all agree, I'm sure. Hundreds of thousands of people running up against barbed wire and machine guns and led by people who weren't even there. So it was a real mess, and no one can quite work out why it happened, because it was who was who and who was fighting for what. Second World War, we were on a different thing altogether, of course. But the world had been through two. Europe had torn itself to bits for twice in one generation. And here we have, just after the Second World War, the Pope making a statement about the body. About saying, look, the Church is not just about spiritual thoughts, it's about human beings, it's about the body. And so to make that point, he went right, talked about Mary, not to make her different from us, but to remind everybody of Mary, the mother of Jesus, was taken, mysteriously, we don't know how, taken into the communion with God. And her body matters, like matter matters. And it's her whole person, her whole memory, her emotions. It doesn't mean body like this stuff. We're not saying any of this is in heaven. Because, I mean, what do you do for toilet paper would be a good start. I mean, it's a whole organisational problem. But you as a human being and I as a human being are taken, all of us, not just our thoughts, but our way of acting, our physical relationships, our loving, all that's taken into the mystery of God. And Mary is seen as a model. What happened to her happens to all of us. So that's the point of this. So it was seen, judged, probably rightly, as something that had to be kind of said with loud, so people would balk and realise we've got to care about the whole human being, not just theological arguments and thoughts. How do we obey the Church when it speaks? But already you can see it's not an issue that's going to affect us in our lives. It's unlikely that it'll ever be used again, I'd say. So it's there on the books. I'm trying to explain it to you as best I can, and it obviously has a very precise direction, and it's only been used once since it was defined. What about our obedience to the Church? Because this is terribly important. What's it mean to be obey the leaders of our Church when they speak? When those who exercise teaching authority in the Church do so through an infallible definition, members of the Church must accept this teaching with the obedience of faith. We accept it because we believe. We believe that Jesus is present in the Church. We believe that the Church, wisely or unwisely, that's not ours to judge, has defined the possibility of this. So when it happens infallibly, we accept it. So I accept that Mary was assumed body and soul, meaning her whole being, into the mystery of God. And you do too, I presume. And we do because we believe, not because it makes sense to us, though it does make a bit of sense. This is because our faith in Jesus and in his will for the Church is at stake here. However, as is obvious, not all the teaching of the Church is on the same level. The Church teaches, it's a science studying Church teaching, as it is law and government and custom law and the whole legal profession. Let's have a look at some of it. The teaching of the Church can be thought of as a series of concentric circles. The inner circle contains those truths that are absolutely central to belonging. If you're going to be a Catholic Christian, this is what we all believe. This inner circle of radical truths is surrounded by a second circle, which contains those truths that must be embraced if we are to truly hold and consistently live by the truths of the inner circle. this is necessary if you're going to actually really believe that. So that's important. Then comes a third circle and a fourth circle until we reach the outer circles about which faithful members of the church can hold a variety of opinions. So from absolute burning uniformity to cultural variations, it's a whopping big story. A man called Francis Sullivan wrote a book called Creative Fidelity, and he says this: the church cannot speak infallibly on every moral issue, regardless of its connections with revelation. They must be able to see how it's part of Jesus' revelation. In order to be capable of being taught with infallibility, a moral doctrine must be either formally revealed or so intimately connected with revealed truth as to be required for the defense of that truth or its exposition. So a lesser degree of acceptance, so that's infallible teaching. Very little of it around, by the way, but we've said it. There's a lesser degree of acceptance is required of the faithful for pronouncements that are declared to be definitive. Pope Paul's statement about women priests, he claimed to be definitive, not infallible. Definitive. Clear, finish the argument, that's the end of it, you're not allowed to talk about it. So I'm not talking about it now. A lesser degree of acceptance is required of the faithful that are declared definitive, but that do not meet the conditions of infallibility. So, it's not absolutely calling on your faith to say yes to it. Sensible and humble respect for the gifts of the Spirit guiding those in authority requires the members of the church that we follow teaching that is presented authoritatively and definitively, even though not infallibly. I mean, we generally start from a position of humility and trust, and here's someone with whatever knowledge they've got that's bigger than what I've got. So on the whole, wouldn't you think the better thing to do would be to obey? Yeah, that's kind of normal human behaviour. This happens when bishops collectively teach something as true, especially if they do so in council, or when the Pope speaks officially on matters that are essentially and necessarily connected to revealed truths. Such proclamations don't call for a response of faith, but they do call for a humble respect of the intellect in accepting such pronouncements and in acting accordingly. So that's a beginning position we have. Now, the Catechism speaks of a third level of teaching. It quotes Vatican II, when, in the exercise of the ordinary magisterium, a teaching is proposed that leads to a better understanding of revelation in matters of faith and morals, the faithful are to adhere to it with religious assent. Problem. Back in the early 1900s, the church came out with statement after statement after statement about the Bible, and they were all wrong. Moses wrote the whole of the Torah, and if you didn't believe that, you'd be kicked out. And this and that and this and that, and time has shown that they were speaking out of ignorance, really. So those who obeyed them at the time and stopped their brain thinking didn't do a good job. Thank God most people said, yes, Your Honour, no, Your Honour, but kept thinking and kept then, and eventually truth emerged. So it's not all positive. What were the leaders of the church trying to do in those early years? They didn't know, so they were worried about the faithful having priests like me get up and blah, 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 you know, or after the Vatican Council, some priest got on the pulpit and said, rosaries, you don't need the rosary, shh, and, you know, stupid stuff, like just stupid pride, or people teaching the New Testament without knowledge themselves and saying, oh, it's all just, it's not facts, it's just all, doesn't, you know what I mean? And disturbing the community out of their proud ignorance because it was fancy and it was a new. So nothing substitutes for the hard work of study and, well, I guess for humility. So we do, okay. We are to adhere with religious respect of intellect and will to the teaching proposed universally by the bishops. If the Vatican Council came up with these wonderful statements, mixed up and compromised and all that, well, we'd be silly to just ignore it all because we've got all these people with their theologians, Pariti, all that coming. We ought to approach the documents with care, but also with an expectation that they will enrich our lives as a community. these teaching proposed universally by the bishops or by the Pope, teaching in harmony with the bishops, when they exercise their authoritative teaching office, even though they don't intend to proclaim these doctrines by a definitive act. They're not saying it's infallible, they're not saying this is the last word and there's nothing else to say, but they're saying, look, this is really important. Well, if I've got any sense, I'll listen. A humble and obedient respect is of a lesser degree than that required by infallible teaching and definitive teaching. And such teaching has its degrees of importance being proposed, what? As definitive in the light of all available knowledge. That's what you do in some, as by way of exhortation or warning. Then there are teachings of individual congregations. I mentioned one a minute ago about the Bible. Individual bishops or moral theologians. Now, if there is a consensus among moral theologians, this will require a more respectful hearing than if we're dealing with one particular moral theologian who's however expert. Or, take scripture, if I was teaching stuff to you now and there was no one else teaching it, and I didn't particularly care whether they were teaching it or not, and I hadn't done any study to get it, and I was blowing off to you, well, hopefully it'd all go home, for God's sake. I would hope. But hopefully, if on the other hand, scholarship around the world, and it's massive and it's wonderful, if someone's in tune with that and trying their best to communicate with you, well, I guess there's more reason for listening, that's all. Knowing that it could all be wrong, but it's the best we can do for the moment in the light of what's known. There's a list. It's a funny little list, but here we are. These are teachings of the church, and they range from a infallible, definitive, definite in the light of available knowledge, approved consensus in theology, exhortation, warning and caution, and the old phrase was offensive to pious ears. You know, like that's the kind of the weakest of them all. It might offend the people, not realizing the people are miles ahead of us anyhow, of the clergy, on these matters, but we don't want to offend them, so we play it safe. Now, this is discerned from the expressed intention of those proclaiming the teaching. Those pronouncing a teaching have to name what it is, and theologians are there to check. So if the Pope Benedict XVI says that what John Paul II said about women priests was infallible, and he did say that, all the theologians of the world say, Benedict, I think you better go back to your book and just do a little bit of work on infallibility. Do you know what I mean? So you've overstated this. The manifestation, Vatican II, of mind and intention is made known principally either by the character of the documents or by the frequency within which the church teaching is proposed or by the manner in which it is formulated. You don't have to know all about this, but somebody has to know about it. Priest has to know about it, bishop has to know about it, theologians have to know about it, and hopefully they can help us focus our attention on it. The key point I'm making, I hope, is clear, is that we have to, whenever people say, what does the church teach, you have to be very careful in answering it. Is there a question, what does the Pope teach? Okay, I can answer that. But what the Pope teaches is not the same as what the church teaches, necessarily. Popes have taught some stuff that wasn't good in the past. So you get me? We've got to be able to, the church teaching ultimately is what the whole Christian community knows to be true. Well, if I think I'm smart enough to dismiss all of that and go my own way, well, I'm a bit too stupid for words. Some teachings are clearly more central, some are more peripheral to the church's faith and life. As one would expect, there have been advances, and so changes in official church teaching on many matters over the centuries. We are being led into fullness of truth. We don't have to have it given on a platter from the beginning. All of us, including popes and bishops, need to re-examine our assumptions and learn from advances in knowledge. We've already noted the huge change in the church's understanding of the workings of grace. Outside the church, there's no salvation, was understood one way when I was a child. No one would understand it that way today. By way of example, I'll give you two other examples. The changes in church teaching in the light of the changed circumstances and deeper insight. These examples should act as a warning to use our discernment when it comes to claim church teaching. Here's two examples. Military service. Okay, Pius XII, Pope, in Christmas 1956, made this statement: a Catholic citizen may not appeal to his conscience as grounds for refusing to serve and fulfil duties fixed by civil law. So all the Catholics in the world said, oh, the Pope said it, so that's important. Vatican II says, laws should make humane provision for the case of conscientious objection who refuse to carry arms provided they accept some other form of community service. So between Pius XII and his advisers making a statement in 56 and the Vatican statement Gaudium et Spes, so that's 65, that's only 10 years, isn't it? 9 years. In that time, people like yourselves examining this matter really carefully said, now wait a minute, there has to be room for conscientious objection. And so the church accepted that. What the church is usually slow to do is to say, Pius XII got it wrong. Like, we're not real good at apologising or admitting. We like to keep the whole thing consistent. Otherwise, pious ears will lose faith in this wonderful institution called the church to get the feel of it. Here's another one on nuclear weapons. Many bishops, I haven't got the data with me, but many bishops, especially in the USA, strongly supported the use of nuclear weapons. Many lay people opposed it. It was their insights which led to a development in church teaching. Here's the statement of Vatican II. Any act of war aimed indiscriminately at the destruction of entire cities, my brother Brian was part of that, he was a gunner in the Lancasters that went over Dresden and the rest of the places and bombed these cities to smithereens. You know, now that's surely a war crime. Was committed, and you got obedience down the line. And we didn't, I don't have to excuse it or anything, just today you couldn't do that. Thank God. But there's, let me back to what Vatican II says, any act of war aimed indiscriminately at the destruction of entire cities or extensive areas along with their population is a crime against God and humanity. It merits unequivocal and unhesitating condemnation. So if there was an American bishop present at the council, he had to eat humble pie and realise he'd been wrong. And hopefully he did. Hopefully he did. You'll be aware of many other issues, where the church, at least in the church's official statements, is out of touch with the insights of good people, including Christians, on what we need to do to liberate people from oppressive systems, to enhance people's lives, and to save our planet, which is threatened by human greed and neglect. Brackets, we might have a bigger job to do on that than we ever realised a week ago. If the church is to connect with people's hunger for spirituality, the world will need to see in the heart and on the face of the church the heart and face of Jesus. Reaching out to everyone with a sacred, inspiring, healing, forgiving, and all-embracing love. That's what the church wants. That's what the world wants. That's what everybody's seeking. So the whole church has to be the heart of God in the world and the face of God. It's no good having a beautiful heart and a bloody wrinkled-up lemon face. So we've got to be... Nietzsche said, if Christians would only smile a bit, he might believe them. Pretty dreadful, but not bad. All these serious Christians wandering around thinking the world is a veil of tears all the time. So that's our job, that's your job, and it's mine.